Und gleichzeitig auf der anderen Seite gab es natürlich auch noch die städtische Verwaltung, die ja nicht weg war. Es gab auch noch den Magistrat und so weiter, die zwar gesagt haben, sie würden die Macht anerkennen des Arbeiter- und Soldatenrats, die aber gleichzeitig gesagt haben, ja, die Reichsregierung in Berlin ist natürlich trotzdem noch eine Instanz, deren Weisungen wir befolgen. Und hier
terminada su función, canción baraja y paloma. Todo cabe en una caja, todo menos la canción. Ponle luto a la pianola, al conejo, a la estrella, al barquito, a la botella, al botellón, a la bola. Música de barracón, canción baraja y paloma, flor de trapo sin aroma. Todo menos la canción. Al gallo, al reloj de cuco, al fonógrafo, al trabuco, al vaso y a la carpeta, su prestidigitación, canción paloma y baraja, el tiempo humilla y ultraja, todo menos la canción. Mucha muerte a poca vida, que lo entiende una vez la reina del ajedrez, y un poeta lo despida. Truco mágico, ilusión, canción baraja y paloma, que todo en broma se toma. Todo menos la canción.
Thank you. days, all that's new. That's new. Particularly that, so, you know what's going on. It's not situations of it's lettres, but that's
Do you need to lie?
I don't think so. Is it common?
No, it's just for you. So your face is covered by the light.
I'll check on that too.
Just change. Oh, but you need to.
I'm not reading, I'm just tossing the.
Okay, so.
Okay. Around the. Which is.
That's it. Then you were in total darkness.
Ah, it's fine. So that's the rest of the issue.
So, do you want to start?
Yeah, okay, good. Lukas.
Yeah, welcome here at the ATC Gallery. I'm very happy to welcome Andrew Hasse here. Ich würde am Anfang ein paar Worte auf Deutsch sagen, um eine kleine Einleitung zu machen. Die Veranstaltung wird heute auf Englisch sein. Da wir eine kleine Runde sind, können wir uns auch irgendwie verständigen, wenn es jemandem irgendwie schwerfällt, Fragen auf Englisch zu stellen. Und können wir das auch auf Deutsch machen und übersetzen es irgendwie zusammen. Und ich würde so zur Einleitung einfach eine kleine Orientierung vielleicht geben, worum es heute gehen wird. Es geht um Isidor Issou. Der geboren wurde als Isidor Goldstein am 29. Januar 1925 in Botoşan in Rumänien, als Sohn von einer bürgerlichen jüdischen Familie, der den Zweiten Weltkrieg als junger Erwachsener in Bukarest erlebt hat, unter dem Regime von Ion Antonescu, der Rumänien ja den Achsenmächten angeschlossen hatte. Und in Bukarest hat Isidor Issou die antisemitischen Pogrome der Eisernen Garde erlebt, ist dieses Pogrom selber nur knapp entkommen, was eine ganz prägende Erfahrung für ihn gewesen ist. Und ist unter diesem Eindruck dann 1945 nach Paris gegangen, um dort eben die Idee des Zentrismus zu gründen, eine künstlerisch-avantgardistische Strömung, die Impulse von Dada am Surrealismus aufgenommen hat, und der es davon ging, mit der ganzen überkommenen Kultur zu brechen, auch eben vor dem Hintergrund der Erfahrungen des Zweiten Weltkriegs in der Shoah. Besonders markant für den Lettrismus sind vielleicht seine Laufgedichte. Also es ging neben dem Lettrismus aber darüber hinaus auch darum, eine neue Sprache zu erfinden, neues Alphabet zu erfinden, im Grunde das ganze Alltagsleben neu zu gestalten und zu revolutionieren. Anfang der 50er Jahre hat die junge lettristische Bewegung dann in Paris für einige Skandale gesorgt und ist später dann ein bisschen bekannt geworden als eine Vorgängergruppierung der Situationistischen Internationale, wobei diese Gruppe um Debord auch diesen ursprünglichen lettristischen Impuls aufgenommen hat, aber sich schnell auch von Issou abgewendet hat, was auch mit der Person Issou zu tun hat, worüber wir heute vielleicht noch einiges erfahren werden. So, I switch into English now. Welcome to the ACC Gallery Weimar. I'm very happy to welcome Andrew Hasse here, who will give us a beginner's guide to Isidor Issou and the prison. And I'm very happy to have Andrew Hasse here today. He wrote a book about Isidor Issou that is called Speaking East, The Strange and Enchanting Life of Isidor Issou. And he came from Paris, where he is living. So he took some kilometers to speak to us and have this conversation with us today. And there are some reasons to focus on Isidor Issou within the program of Kunstspektakel and Revolution. Last year in our program, we focused on avant-garde movements in Eastern Europe. And one reason to have this focus was to say, when we want to understand the history of avant-garde movements in the 20th century, we can't do it without having an understanding of the influences of the different art movements in Eastern Europe. As I said before, the title of Andrew Hasse's book is Speaking East, and he also shows in his book that some things that happened in Paris after the Second World War go back to influences from Eastern Europe and also from Eastern Jewish and Yiddish culture. And as well, Issou is one figure whom we can understand this. Another reason to focus on Isidor Issou within our program is the Situationist International and the Situationist Theory of Revolution and Art. Always was an important reference for our program. And when you read books about the history of the Situationists and the group around Debord, you will find the name of Isidore Isou as a figure who was, in a way, important for the prehistory of the Situationists. But you will find him as a person that was, in a kind, a maniac, self-centered, maybe just a footnote of the Situationist context. When you have a look on the biography of Isidore Isou himself, you would find that this idea as a kind of gesture was very important for that what later became Situationism. And you will find something that was very important for Isidore Isou was later painfully missing in the Situationist theory, the experience of the Shoah and anti-Semitism and of Jewish diaspora. So after reading Andrew Hussey's book about Isidore Isou, for me it was clear we have to do something about Isidore Isou here in Weimar, and I really wanted to invite Andrew Hussey. Andrew Hussey comes from Great Britain. He studied French and Romance languages in Manchester and Lyon. He's living in Paris now, and he researched about Georges Bataille, about the Situationist International and Guy Debord, and he wrote many texts and books about French and British history. So I'm happy to have you here today.
Thanks very much. Thank you. That's a very, very generous welcome and very precise and accurate as well. I hope it hasn't stolen too much of what I'm going to say, because what he said is very true. And before I begin, there is in this book and in today's talk one very big idea, and that is this: that what we think of as Western modernity, or if you like, the revolutionary avant-garde of Western modernity, and we think of a family tree that goes from Dada, Surrealism, to Situationism, there's a gap. There's a big gap. There's an absence. There's something missing. And that something missing is, I would argue, Lecturism. And behind that is something even more important, which is that Lecturism doesn't come from the West. It comes from the East. It comes from the Jewish East. The techniques, the ideas, the philosophy, they come from things, you know, that belong to the Kabbalah, that belong to a Jewish mystical tradition from the East. Now, I don't think that there's been a deliberate campaign against Isidore Isou, but it just seems to me it's very, very interesting that when we think of the West and Western modernity, and the component parts of Western modernity, that we're missing this Oriental, this Eastern effect, because the two come together in revolutionary thinking. But anyway, to begin properly, my name is Andrew Hussey. I live in Paris principally because I write about France and Parisian avant-garde, and that's why I write about Isidore Isou. And before I even begin, I'll just tell you how I came to write the book. I was very, very lucky in 1999 to meet Isou. He was then very old, he was 74 years old. He lived in poverty in a small flat in the Rue Saint-André-Bizard. He was very ill, he couldn't walk. And he lived in this tiny flat that basically was la misère. It was wretched, it was poor. And he was cared for by a guy called Roland Sabatier, who was a lettriste in Paris. But the thing is that I went to see Isou. And I went to see about Guy Debord, because I was writing then a book about Guy Debord. And I needed to speak to Isou, because the men had been friends for a long time. Well, for a very short period of time, but very intense friends. And then they hated each other. And Isou described Debord to me as a Nazi. He said he was worse than a Nazi. But I wanted to understand why, not just why Isou said this, but this was a really, from sort of like Isou, this was a massive, massive injury, a massive insult. So I needed to understand that. And I was told by Situationists in Paris, before I met Isou, that he was mad. He was completely mad. And it's true that he had been interned in the mental hospital of Sainte-Anne for some years, at certain points. And I came to know very well somebody called Guy Marouani, who was Isou's psychiatrist for a long time. Isou, yes, had severe mental health problems, which I'll talk about too. But they're not to do with maths, they're to do with trauma, which is something else. And they're to do with the trauma of the shore, which is something else. So, as you started talking, and I was there for about 4, 5, 6 hours with my tape recorder, the 19th tape recorder. You don't even know what that is. Tape recorder. And he told me the story of his life. And it was fascinating. But also, I thought, this is historic. This needs to be in a book. And, you know, it was like one of those moments when you meet someone and you go in for one thing and you come out and say, hey, it's completely different. So I started thinking about the book and starting to understand Isun. And that's really what I'm going to do today, finish there. I want to put together the life and the work, because although Lettice de Paris will say to you, and he said to me, there is no connection between Jewishness and Lettism. There is no connection between Isun's life and his work. You can't separate the two. So, a beginner's guide to Isidore Isun, speaking East, the making of a name, and a Messiah. And this is the title that's going to be explained and unpacked. Strange and Enchanted Life. So I'm just going to give you very quickly an overview of the life, which you can divide into three main sections. But to begin, I'm going to begin with two main sections. The first one is a Romanian youth, that is his childhood in Botoşan and Bucharest, in Romania, obviously. Now, these locations are not innocent, they're important. They're important because Botoşan, in the northeast of Romania, was not quite a shtetl, but it was very Jewish. But also very cosmopolitan, in the sense there were lots of Christians, there were Greeks, there were Jews, there were Russians, there were lots of languages around at the time. And it was also a fairly sophisticated place intellectually. It had an important university. Romania's national poet, do you know the name of Mihai Eminescu? Mihai Eminescu? He's the Shakespeare of Romania. He's the national poet of Romania, an ambitious anti-Semite, and he was born and raised in Botoşan. So that had cultural significance. Botoşan is also near the city of Iași, which during the Second World War was the scene of many massacres of the Jews. And northeastern Romania was one of the crucibles of anti-Semitism in Romania. So Isun grew up in this very charged atmosphere. When he goes to Bucharest, he encounters something else. He encounters the Romanians at that time used to call Bucharest Micul Aris. Micul in Romanian means the small Paris, the petit Paris. And the idea was that Bucharest is the Paris of the East. The architecture of Parisian, some of it still is now. The culture was definitely Parisian. People read Marcel Proust and all the way to Dawn and the Darwinist manifestos. The first language of intellectuals and artists was always French. And as a young man, this is the milieu that attracted Isun. At the same time, he was also involved in a journal called Palestina, and he was a convinced Zionist, and he worked for this Zionist journal. And at one stage, he wanted to go to Israel. This is just after the war. But so we've got a combination of Jewish politics and French stroke European avant-gardism. And this word here, another Romanian word, uligane. Anyone know this word? No? No? Anyone guess what the word might mean? It's an Irish word, it means hooligan. The hooligan. Uligane. And the Uligane in Romania in the 1930s and 40s were very interesting. They were kind of like proto-punks, delinquents. rebels. The word had its origins in worship, actually. This version of the word had its origins in worship. Obviously, it comes from Irish. It was used to describe the Irish in London in the 19th century, who were all criminals, villains, and general bad people, the hooligans. The hooligans then became used in worship used by Lenin and then Stalin to describe what they called the wreckers of society. People who are nihilists, people who are anti-communists, but at the same time had no real politics at all. They believed in nothing, they were nihilists. And then when it came to Bucharest, it came to mean groups of young people who drank heavily, raped each other, talked about suicide, who were constantly negating the values of the society, the bourgeois society that they lived in. And Izum, for a while, was an hooligan, and he described this experience to me of being a hooligan. And it's interesting to me two things, that first of all, many of these hooligan became fascists, which you can see is sort of, you know, reasonably inevitable trajectory, in a way. And they became part of the Romanian Iron Guard. But Izum took from them the energy to be a delinquent, the energy to say no. And I think he looked back on his days as a hooligan as the beginning, in some ways, of his career as a professional revolutionary. Here's another quotation. God loves everything anti-Yid. God loves everything anti-Yid. What does that mean? God loves everything anti-Yid. Well, it's in a certain place at a certain time. Izum, in this book here, that yes or no, the Messie, he describes his youth quite accurately, and he describes how it's like growing up as a Jew in Bucharest before and during the war. And at one stage in the book, he's on a train, surrounded by Christians, fascists of the Iron Guard. And they start to torment him and insult him. And then one of them says to him, why didn't you go to Palestine? Why didn't you be insect, you vampire? Why didn't you go to bloodsucker? Why didn't you leave Romania? This is not your country. And he says, well, you know, he says, but God loves Jews. And then this fascist replies, God loves everything anti-Yid. Now, for Izum, that moment was an illumination. At that moment, he understood that if Christians hated him, he had to hate Christians. It was the only response. So we've got this almost dialectical response. It's the power of negating a statement. So Izum is thinking, if God loves everything anti-Yid, the Yid will love everything anti-God. Does that make sense? It's a complete reversal. It's like everything you think is good, I think is bad. Everything I think is bad, you think is good. Does that make sense? But it doesn't. It's almost like a kind of mystical illumination for Izum that this is how I'm going to think in the future. And the title of this book is called La Guerre de l'Indépendance, The Making of a Name and a Messiah, because it's this moment Izum realizes something mad, absurd, impossible, but which he really believed. He truly believed, this is the mystical illumination, that he was the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah, who had been sent to earth to lead the revolution, to lead an avant-garde revolution, to lead a letterist revolution, which was find a new way of being human. And this new way of being human had to happen because with fascism, anti-Semitism, massacres, killings, atrocities, the world had come to an end. The Christian world was finished. The world of the Enlightenment was finished. The world of Western reason was finished. To replace it, there had to be a new form of humanity. And that new form of humanity, in Zoom, was going to tell you, going to lead the way. The new form of humanity had to be Jewish. Il faut juiser le monde. The world must become Jewish. So if you see dealing with a man who thinks in absolutes all the time, good, bad, good, evil, evil, good, reverse, good, evil, evil, good, reverse. Does that make sense? And you can see the link here with surrealism, for example. You can see that dialectical way of thinking that goes back to Hegel, or even goes back to alchemy, in fact. Because alchemy is all about the art of transformation. It's all about turning one thing into another. The surrealists married Hegelianism, Marxism, but the surrealists, as I'm sure you know, loved alchemy as well. They put the two together, and in poetry, in words, the world could be transformed. Transforming the world, the revolution, began with words. Let's stop there for a minute. Is this too bad, or does it make sense? You don't have to, you've got no Andrew, this is just insane. You know, why are you here? It's mad. But I think it is mad, because I think it is mad. And it does go mad, but it's still, you know, there's still a kind of truth in his madness. Okay, here's some Romanian for you. It's easy. Nu e bada, e bada. What? Nu e bada, nu e dada, e bada. Nu e dada, e bada. I love that. There's a review of the book Speaking East in the London Review of Books, and the headline, they copied the headline from my book. I said, nu ye dada, ye bada. For the first time, a London Review of Books has got something right. You know, it was a lovely sight to see that in London Review of Books. Please do that. What does it mean? It was a formula formulated by Izu in 1944 when he was beginning his journey towards revolutionary thinking. And it's easy to translate. Looks like this. It isn't Dada. This is not Dada, what he's doing. Ye Bada. Bada is difficult to translate. But in Romanian, the word for yes in Romanian is Da. And the word Bada, I don't know what you say in German, but in French, if you want to contradict someone, you know, if you say to me, well, I think he's an idiot, and I go, oh, no. No, no. That's very French, isn't it? Mais non, monsieur. And they're doing far better than English. Mais non, monsieur. I live in Paris long ago. That's the typical, you know, it's in default mode. But that means, mais non. So we translate this as, it isn't Dada. It's something else. Does that make sense? And that's the beginning of lecturism, and that's the beginning of moving from surrealism to lecturism, which will take us to situationism, and ultimately revolution. Again, this picture of Izu, it is on the other streets, looking like the Ungaris, very cool. Lecturism, situationism, revolution. This is the period 1945, 1968. I said I was going to divide it up into two initial sections. And this is the period that takes us to May 68. And of course, May 68, many cultural historians, especially French, and I think they're right, have now decided the key philosophy or key ideology, not really, ideology behind May 68 belonged to the Situationists. And I've put here some graffiti from 1953, when his Guy Debord was actually still a leftist. And it says, "Ne travaillez jamais." I don't speak French here. What does that, do you know what it means?
Never work.
Never work. And that's been my philosophy my whole life. I'm actually not joking. I don't believe in work. Never work. It's funny, but it's true. And where it comes from a poem by Rambo. And Rambo, the poet Rambo, obviously. And Rambo is looking out his window. He's young, he's a teenager, basically. And he sees people working in the fields, you know. And he says, Jamais, I'm never going to work. I had that feeling when I was 17. What's the point? It's stupid. I don't believe in it. I don't want to be a slave to capitalist stupidity. No. Like, 17, I'm 59, never changed. I don't believe in work. But it's a serious slogan as well, Ne travaillez jamais, because when Guy Debord says Ne travaillez jamais, never work, it doesn't just mean sit around all day watching television, smoking skunk weed, doing nothing, being a consumer of the society of the spectacle. But what he means is live. Live, don't work. And this is a very important idea that Guy Debord took from the Dutch sociologists. If our Dutch friends are listening to me, they will correct my pronunciation, of somebody called Johan Hansinger. Now, Hansinger wrote a very important book for the Situationists called Hollow Lunettes, Man at Play. Do you know this book? You do, yeah, so you do. Well, let me remind you of the big idea in the book. The big idea is there are two forms of human being. Homo faber, the man who makes, or the man and woman who makes, works, does things, or homo ludens, the man who plays. Which is more important? Any ideas? But you want to know what Hansinger says? He says, homo ludens is more important than homo faber, because all human society that we call civilization is based on play and not work. A society based on work is a slave society. It's not a civilized society. A society based on play is what we should aspire to. Creativity, poetry, sex, love, improvisation, all the things that happened in the 1960s began with this notion of play being more important than work. Does this seem mad? I think so, does it? So, Ne travaillez jamais, this becomes the slogan of 1968 for many students in Paris. And if you go to Paris now, this Ne travaillez jamais, this graffiti, the veto. There are many young people in Paris, particularly at the moment with a lot, because a lot of political agitation in France at the moment, who use Situationist ideas and slogans. And if you go around France, not just Paris, but Paris, Marseille, and different places, you'll see a lot of anarchist Situationist slogans in graffiti. One of them is this, Ne travaillez jamais. I was going to the Italian shop near my house, and I went down to get some pasta the other day, and I saw this graffiti. It said, on the clever bad bully, we are not going to die of work. These ideas are still here. They're still in people's heads. And this particular graffiti, it's all over the Seine, and in the Situationists, even now, every time the police wipe it out, if they do, even now, they go back and do it in exactly the same writing as this, as a kind of homage to Guy Debord. And the idea behind it is, this is the route of Seine, which is the frontier between the right bank and the left bank. The right bank is known for commerce, politics. The left bank is supposed to be for play. It's a playground for love, sex, and adventure. Or at least that's the idea. It's not anymore, but he's what's big. Right, poetry. This is Lettres poetry. And I thought I would give you some Lettres poetry before I explain the theory behind it, because I think the practice is more important than the theory in some ways. This is a photograph of two young Lettres outside of Barco and the Magnon, which is still there. It's actually a very posh gay bar now, but those days it was more of a, what they call a toque, it's more of a dive. They're not like cooks, so they're a good thing as well. Certainly drunk in the middle of the day, in the middle of Paris. But I mean, I think it's a fantastic photograph, it's a good photograph. I think it tells you something about youth culture at the time. Two young Lettres, the streets of Paris. Paris, Paris, étranger. That's the title of the poem, which in English, obviously, is Paris Seen by a Stranger. This is one of the first poems which Bizou wrote when he came to Paris. And he describes his response to the city in a very unique way. Now, before I read it, because I can read it in the same voice as Bizou, because Bizou explained to me how to read it, I'd like you just to read it to yourselves and imagine that you have no language. Imagine that you have no language. What do you hear when you read this in your head? So I'll just give you 30 seconds to do that, okay? Starting now. Read it in your head. Don't listen to me. Read the poem in your head. Read the poem in your head. Don't listen to me. Something will happen when you read the poem in your head. Okay, so, right. We don't speak any language. I don't speak any German, so, you know, that's my problem. That's something which I should have been, you know, about years ago, but I don't speak any German. So when I'm in Germany, which is quite often, I don't understand what's going on in certain places at certain times. I have no language. So Izu is a young migrant. He's escaped from Romania. He arrives in Paris. He's got no language. I'm going to read this out and ask you what you think it means. Paris, vous parlez français. Pigalle, les catanes, Escorial, Champs-Élysées, les Poutanes, les Baranes, Saint-Germain, Bourniche, Tricariche, Saint-Louis, Ouchkiche. Hello, baby. Obre, traine, Yankee d'or, coro. You're a fucking noodle. All right, lady. Is this just complete noise? Or is something happening at this point? I think something's happening. So I'd like to know what you think it is. Because I know.
Kind of repetition of what you hear in the streets, or like the collage of sounds and English, French, like words you hear very often and make maybe no sense if you don't understand, but you...
I think it's brilliant. You're absolutely right. I think it's a brilliant poem because poetry, the poet writes a poem. It's kind of vertical. The author writes object. In this, it's not vertical, it's horizontal. He's looking around him. Himself. He's in Paris. He doesn't understand what he's hearing, but he hears noises. And the noises mean something. But he doesn't know what they mean. And I think, you know, when you're in the middle of something, don't understand what's going on. When you're in a horizontal position, you don't understand what's going on. You can feel it, you can sense it, you can hear it, you don't understand it. And this is, if you want to, an owl, a sound description of what it felt to be young in Paris, a migrant on the street in 1945, I think this is it. Now, the only French words in it are les catins, which means horse, and he tells us this as well, les coutins, French horse. The rest of the French sounding words are nonsense, just invented noise. Tugoriche, Saint-Riche, Saint-Riche, obviously, Bouchiche, but then what he's hearing, hello, baby, public lady. Paris is full of American GIs trying to pick up prostitutes. And the prostitutes would use it, hello, baby, like that's American GIs. Yankee doodle doodle. I don't know, Yankee something. Noodle, fucky noodle. Yeah. Fucky, what, fucky, you, fucky, fuck, fuck, etc. All right, lady. Is it making sense now? So just for our amusement, I'll read it again. Pigalle, which is the red light district of Paris. That's a clue. Les catales, scoriales, chanzanites, catales, les balades, sentimental, riche, riche, serviche, riche. Hello, baby. Pobre, trady. Yankee, good, good. You're the fuck you do. It's that kind of early version of rap, in some ways. But the thing, because it's built on noise, sound, and effect, and rhythm. Noise, sound, effect, and rhythm have replaced meaning. Right? Number one, that is what lecturism does. It replaces meaning with sound. It's a new form of poetry. That's a lot already, isn't it? It's a new form of poetry. I think it is. Now, one of Lithu's ambitions was to flood Paris with lecturist poetry. He's very charismatic, he's very good looking, and he gathered young people around him as a kind of gang, as a gang of hooligans, many of them Jewish, many of them refugees, many of them in the city, you know, with no money, making a living as rent boys or, you know, prostitutes or just living off the streets. And so he wanted to form a gang of hooligans who would read poetry aloud in the streets with tambourines. And these he called the lecturist symphonies. The lecturist symphonies. And the idea was to provoke a reaction with ordinary people in the street. Now, a poem like this, maybe it's young men and women are banging tambourines and they're reading this out. It's good, it's exciting, it's funny, etc. But what about this? This is another poem written in the same way, in the same period. Crie pour 5 millions de juifs, 5 milliards de juifs, égorgés, 1945. Cries for 5 million Jews with their throats cut in 1945. Now, this is a poem that young lecturists would read out in the streets deliberately to provoke an extreme reaction. Let's listen to the poem before we decide what that reaction would be. By day, red grenade, got yaf, mensch, baf, straf. By day, I, see, egoge. Gerange, Himmler, Gimler, Behang, Auschwitz, Schwitz, Schwitz. That's very good. This isn't so funny, is it? What's going on, do you think? Well, let's have a look at the... It's not really German, is it? But Gott jaf, Mensch, Baf, Strap. What does that mean? Anything? Or is it just noise? I think it's what Izu hears as a Jew. the German language. He doesn't understand it.